For SDPB Radio, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment, and welcome to the In the Moment podcast. This week, we hear from folks at the new Addiction Treatment Center Project Recovery and what they're seeing regarding addiction in the state. The executive director of the South Dakota Retailers Association joins us to talk about the evolution of retail in South Dakota and the role online shopping has played. USD's Sustainability and Environment Chair discusses with us the value of native ecosystems and why we should value our grasslands. The South Dakota Game Fish and Parks Wildlife Division Director talks with us about South Dakota's growing zebra mussel problem, and SDPB's China Locket reports on Cheyenne River Sioux tribal officials saying they need emergency funding to fix damaged roads. But first, every news podcast, we feature the political junkies from the state to talk about the week's top political stories affecting your community. This week, we welcomed John Hunter with the Madison Daily Leader and John Schaff, political science professor at Northern State University. We talked about the Pentagon launching surveillance balloons over South Dakota and the American Civil Liberty Union's concerns over privacy. And we also covered John Hunter's op-ed, shining a light on South Dakota's need for more mental health professionals. All right, gentlemen, let's start out with the surveillance balloons. The balloons themselves were actually manufactured by Raven in South Dakota, and they've launched as part of a persistent surveillance system for narcotic trafficking and homeland security threats. John Hunter, start us off with this one. What do you make of this story?
Well, there's, of course, two sides to every story, sometimes many more. But in this case, so the federal government is trying to get a system set up for surveillance or tracking narcotics trafficking, in which a lot of people think that's a good idea, right? If we have illegal trafficking of narcotics, we'd want to get those. Pretty high-tech situation, send up these balloons, which seem low-tech, but, you know, they can get up to 65,000 feet, and it's a little like the U-2 spy plane, right, at 70,000 feet from 50 or 60 years ago. And high-tech radar and cameras and so forth, apparently very good. The flip side is, of course, that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution says that you know, we can't have kind of illegal searches, or, you know, can't come into your house or search you without probable cause. And so I think some people, including the ACLU, are concerned that this is some sort of searching Big Brother kind of surveillance without probable cause. So we've got two sides working here.
All right, John Schaff, what are some of your initial thoughts?
Well, they're kind of alongside John's, and it reminds me of the debates we had when we were talking many years ago now about the Patriot Act. And one of the things that's going on here is that the government can surveil us, but precisely as John's just indicating, because of the Fourth Amendment, any information they use, I don't know how they could possibly use it in court of law. I am not a lawyer, but I play one sometimes in the classroom. And it's problematic because you have no warrant. And so how that it's one thing to be surveilling people for national security reasons, which is how under the Patriot Act they got away with some of the provisions there, is that the intention was not to use it in the court of law and the information that they would get from that surveillance. And so without a warrant, I don't know how you could use this information. And I think the other concern is simply the collection of data, even if it's never used for anything, that the fact that the government would have so much information about us, it's not dissimilar to concerns people have about surveillance with technology, the way Google or Facebook oftentimes without our knowledge are gathering information about us. And my guess is that their intentions are benign, but we shouldn't be so naive, whether it's about corporations or about our government, when they gather all sorts of information about us and they're storing that. And we can't just assume that it's always going to be a benign use of that information. I'm sure that's part of what's motivating the ACLU.
All right, so we talk about narcotics surveillance, but there's also this idea of homeland security threats, which they've clearly said is a possibility. And John Schaff brings up the Patriot Act. Are we focusing, John Hunter, too much on the fact that these balloons are going to be used to stop narcotics trafficking? Governor Kristi Noem said, hey, if we can help, launch your balloons. Certainly we don't want drug trafficking. But what about this homeland security component? There seems to be more to the story there.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not sure where that is going exactly. So for some of us, it kind of took us by surprise. We didn't know this was kind of coming. The FCC approved that and went ahead and launched, and they didn't call the Madison Day leader to tell us they were going to do this. And so we're trying to follow up with that. I think the idea when you go homeland security or even the term probable cause, you expand it so broadly that it almost becomes, you can surveil anything. And as John pointed out, collecting all this data, and then could you, for example, if you saw something suspicious, you saw that on your tape, then you race off to a judge, get a warrant, and then further follow that person. Does that? So yes, you could theoretically in court be using the data after you got the warrant, but you used kind of non-warranted information to get it in the first place, and that confuses me.
John Schaff, you could use it to monitor, pipeline protests as people might attack infrastructure. That would be a homeland security conversation, would it not?
Potentially, and I think this is sort of what we're getting at, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of arguments the ACLU puts forward on this. What we're seeing is that this line between law enforcement and homeland security is not exactly bright and shiny, and it doesn't need to be crystal clear, but it maybe needs to be more brighter and shinier than it is. Because it allows the government, depending if they've got if the balloons are there and they're surveilling, it allows the government when convenient to say this is law enforcement, and then when it's convenient to say this is homeland security. And it seems like you'd want something more definitive than that to not allow the government to justify what it's already doing based on kind of expedience. And so I think it's something, I don't think I know enough about the law to be definitive about it, but I think I know enough to be concerned, and we'll see how this plays out.
John Hunter, do you think we'll get more definitive information from the government about the intention of these balloons, when they're deployed, when they aren't? Are you connecting the same dots that I was there?
Well, I kind of have a question for you guys, too, this as it relates to that. First of all, this is a temporary situation. I think it only stays in effect for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something like that. So there may be something after that they would need to renew that. But how is this much different from spy satellites that are currently all over the globe and that are already doing this kind of work? Is this a different technology? How is that there? I assume the satellites are looking at us already, right? At least when we see, installations of North Korean missiles from space. What's the difference here between those balloons and satellites?
Well, I think I can answer that, which is precisely who owns those satellites. And we're reaching the extremities of my knowledge, but I would guess that most of those satellites are owned by the National Security Administration, which falls under the Department of Defense. And the Department of Defense is not supposed to be operating within the United States borders. And so they can do those things precisely because they're surveilling North Korea or some compound in Afghanistan. And so that allows them to do that because, you don't need a warrant to surveil North Korea. That's not part of the criminal justice system. But when you're operating within the boundaries of the United States, now you're dealing with citizens. Well, any person within the United States has constitutional rights. The Constitution isn't limited to persons, to citizens. It's persons. Anyone within the United States has constitutional rights, and that's why I think this is iffy. And so it's always the question. So we had these questions when we were debating the Patriot Act. Is this line of we know now in the kind of the age of terrorism, and even in this case, maybe even narco-terrorism, that this line between national defense and internal criminal justice is sometimes a little blurred. But I think it behooves us to question the government, to even if ultimately, I'm not even saying that these balloons and the surveillance is wrong or illegal, but we need to be vigilant as citizens, and that's what the ACLU is doing, to make sure that they can give an account of this in a court of law, that we're forcing them to define as well as they can where criminal justice ends and where Homeland Security begins, or vice versa.
And to clarify a few things here from the Argus Leader report, it says the FCC authorized the corporation's temporary balloons on July 12th. The authorization expires on September 1st. So I'm presuming there that if there's an extended authorization, that we would learn about it from through similar channels. And according to The Guardian, reported that the U.S. Southern Command commissioned the tests, and the balloons are carrying sensors and communication gear capable of detecting every vehicle in motion in a 25-mile range beneath the balloon. So potentially, not only who owns the balloon, but what the you know, technology is actually capable of, if this is testing a new technology that can track vehicles day or night in any kind of weather.
I should wash my car more often if I knew they were going to be watching it.
And also, well, be careful what song you're singing along to. You never know. They might know.
I'm not sure that's the most salient point of the day, but it's...
You can always count on me to deliver non-salient points, Lori.
All right, let's move along and talk a little bit about John Hunter's work, a recent editorial in the Madison Daily Leader about finding mental health professionals for South Dakota. How important is this, John, that we really focus on this as a state?
I think it's extremely important, and the idea is that a lot of our criminal justice system is dealing with issues relating to mental health or counseling, whether it be addiction counseling or all those sorts of things. And I think in a lot of cases, people believe, and I might even say the majority of South Dakotans would say that it's better to treat a drug addiction problem and get it solved rather than incarcerating a person for long periods of time. And of course, the state can appropriate money for that, and we can set up the framework for doing that. But if you don't have those mental health professionals and addiction counselors and all that, then nothing gets done. And there is, I think, an extreme shortage of those, and we see that in several areas, not only the criminal justice system, but also at the Human Services Center and Sioux Falls. It wouldn't surprise me that private hospitals that offer mental health services would be short also. So the idea is that we're going to have to recruit those somehow. We're going to have to train somehow. But I think it's a real deal. There seems to be, you know, and I don't want to tie this necessarily to mass shootings, but in almost all those cases, those are mental health issues that are going with that. That you can't say that good counseling would prevent that, but I think criminal justice is full of these circumstances, and I think we desperately need more people who can help.
South Dakota has one of the lowest death rates from overdose in the nation, but that doesn't mean the state isn't facing its own opioid crisis. A new facility in Rapid City seeks to treat those struggling with addiction before it's too late. Tim Alward is the clinical director for Project Recovery. This week, he and Shelby Thompson, a social worker with Project Recovery, joined in the moment to give us an overview of why Project Recovery was started and what addiction looks like in our state. How did the conversation about needing this kind of facility begin?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lori. So as you mentioned, I'm the clinical director, but our founder and owner is Dr. Stephen Tamang, and he is a family health physician with Regional, and about a year and a half ago started to see the need for this treatment. I mean, he had a lot of patients who were more or less addicted to opioids, and that can show up in a number of different ways, but multiple patients who came to him for help. And he went through the process of getting a specific waiver, which is required to be able to prescribe a specific medication called Suboxone. And that is the treatment for opioid use disorder. Anyway, he started that about a year and a half ago, and it quickly grew. Fast forward to today, where we have 7 providers, a burgeoning nursing staff, social worker, and hopefully counseling coming on board soon as well.
Is the problem going to peak and then sort of fade away as we deal with things? Where are we at in this arc?
That's a great question as well. So obviously, the more that we do of this, the more we realize that there is a need. And as of this point, we're adding about a new patient every day. So the trajectory is I think it's more awareness. And I don't know if I could say, you know, in terms of the broader epidemiology picture, hey, is the trajectory up or is it down? All that we know is that we've started to provide a service and it's been proven to be especially needed and useful, at least in Western South Dakota.
Tim, let's stick with you for a minute and tell us about Project Recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. So Project Recovery started in October of last year. It started with a couple of providers, myself, Troy Thompson, Dr. Tamang, and we began to see folks using medication-assisted treatment, which is the gold standard for opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder. As I mentioned before, to be able to prescribe the specific medications for opioid use disorder, which is called Suboxone, it requires a specific waiver. So there are certain barriers to entry to treat this population. However, it's unfortunate because this medication does wonders for people. And not only is it for the typical heroin user, we're also treating people in their 50s, their 60s, their 70s who are addicted to opioids. And that can look like someone who had a hip or a knee or a shoulder surgery 5, 10, 15 years ago and has just been on escalating doses of opioids since that time. So we're really seeing a need, and it's bimodal. I mean, we see people in the very young, in their late teens and 20s, what you would typically describe as a as an opioid abuser. And we also see the folks to the edges, to the periphery, 50, 60, 70s.
Shelby Thompson, you're a social worker with Project Recovery. Tell me a little bit about how your role comes into what Tim is talking about.
Well, like Tim said, we have a really wide spectrum of individuals coming. And so their background really determines what their recovery is going to look like. So if you're someone that maybe is just recovering from like he said, a surgery, and it's and you just, I mean, very accidentally became like hooked on these medications, your treatment is going to look a little differently than someone who has maybe been using heroin on the street for years and is homeless and has a lot of instability in their life. So we sort of work to do really holistic treatment, but also based on exactly what the patient or client is looking for. So if you come in and say, this is my situation, then we can tell you obviously what would be ideal for you. Like, hey, let's get you set up with counseling. Let's get you set up with a doctor to get you a physical because you haven't been to the doctor in years. But it just all depends on what they want. So we help them, we help pair them with services to meet their needs and to meet them right where they're at, because our whole principle of treatment from the social work side, and I guess the medical side too, is just based on harm reduction. So even if we don't get you to what the ideal state would be, like if we know that you could really benefit from counseling, but you're just not interested, we still see it as a win, just that we've got you on this medication to help fight at least one of your battles. Mm. So
tell me, Shelby, how you work with families and what sort of, you know, what sort of journey does a family member take on as their loved one goes through this kind of treatment?
You know, it can be, I think, as we would all suspect, really, really difficult. And that's why we're so happy to have, we refer out for a lot of that sort of counseling to get families and their loved one to be able to work together. The South Dakota Avoid Opioid, they've done a lot of great stuff with getting like peer recovery and peer support, not only for the patients, but also for their families. So mothers have another mother to talk to about what it's like and how to process. And I myself, we haven't done a lot through Project Recovery specifically with families. That's a component I'd really love to add. But yeah, for right now, we mostly refer out so people can get the counseling and then hopefully that family component goes along with that.
Yeah. And Tim, tell me more about, expand on what Shelby was saying about reducing harm. What does that look like in real life?
Yeah, harm reduction is really at the core. And it's a term that would be very familiar to those who treat substance abuse. Harm reduction essentially takes an activity that someone's doing that has the potential to really hurt them, i.e. IV drug use, and it essentially cuts down on the harm of what that could end up happening, what could end up happening to that patient. Essentially, we are looking at things like needle exchange programs, which are funded by the CDC to provide people with clean needles. And I know that's a bit of a shocker, but that's one thing that we could reduce rates of abscesses, infection, HIV, hepatitis C, which are a huge burden on our economy. So things like that, things like giving patients the benefit of the doubt when it comes to giving them the medications that they need. And what I mean by that is there's this kind of understanding, or at least a thought, that there's some diversion going on. And what that means is just that, hey, are these patients selling the medications? And it turns out that buprenorphine or Suboxone accounts for about 1% of all drugs that are being diverted on the market. So it's a very, very low percentage. Along with that, it's a medication that's incredibly safe to use. Harm reduction says, you know, we're going to give these patients what they need. We're going to hopefully reduce the amount of adverse effects that come along with this type of behavior.
The report of my death was an exaggeration, writes Nathan Sanderson in his op-ed piece this week. Sanderson is executive director of the South Dakota Retailers Association, and he wasn't referring to himself there. He was quoting Mark Twain. He was stressing the resurgence of Main Street, South Dakota, and he says the future of brick-and-mortar retail is bright. Yes, even in the face of online sales making up a bigger chunk of the market. This particular, you know, op-ed that you were writing was about competing with online sales, and let's look at some of those numbers. What do you know?
Well, there's no question that when you turn on the television or you listen to the radio or you open the newspaper, you see reports and stories of retail stores closing, that it's absolutely happening across the country. Well, it's helpful to keep in mind that, well, yes, there's absolutely an evolution going on, but the death of retail is quite a long way off, I'm confident.
How important was the Wayfair decision, which required online sales tax collection? How important was that to sort of evening that playing field? How do you see, you know, the recent changes in how we deal with online sales?
Well, it's interesting, for a lot of brick-and-mortar retailers, that topic actually started with catalog sales, as I mentioned before. There was a Supreme Court case that said that catalog sales weren't subject to state sales and use tax because they didn't have nexus or a physical presence within the state. And so retailers in South Dakota have been working on that issue for almost four decades. And so the advent of online sales really made that of even greater importance. Your question was, how big was that? Oh, it was huge. It was absolutely essential to ensuring that level playing field, because right now the lines between what you purchase in a brick-and-mortar store and what you purchase online are very much blurred. You know, just a few moments ago you had an advertisement for market play and returns, and that could be an interesting discussion for people. So think about, you know, buying something online and then returning it to a physical store. Where exactly was the purchase made? Well, it was made online, okay, but you've got to have some way to return that. Now, of course, some entities allow you to do that by mail. Other entities require you to do that in person. And so the Wayfair decision was, I think, just another step in the evolving nature of retail that really demonstrated that brick-and-mortar stores are now on a similar playing field to internet retailers.
Talk a little bit, when we talk about innovating and trying to figure out how to do business for retailers in South Dakota, how do I do business now that competes with some of that that online push, that competes with you know, the other businesses that are my competitors? How do you look at some of those things like customer service and ease of returns?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a really great question, and one we could talk about for a long time. You know, when you talk about business ethic, you know, years and years and years ago, decades ago, it was very much a buyer beware situation. When you walked out of the store with that item, if it didn't work for you, if it happened to break down, if it wasn't the right size, if you didn't end up using it, well, that was just customer tough luck. That was sort of the way that it was. And then, of course, a much higher level of customer service came into play. And so right now, the idea that you would be unable to return something to a store after you had purchased it because it didn't fit would be just absolutely shocking to a consumer. Well, of course, because retail businesses have changed the changing nature of the consumer's tastes and desires. And obviously, the internet is part and parcel to that. The convenience of being able to research things online is unmatched. I mean, I could do it while I'm having this conversation with you on my phone. And who knows, maybe a number of our listeners are doing that same thing, right? They're probably driving. their passenger might be browsing the internet for a new mattress or new furniture or a new pair of shoes or something like that. Very convenient. But what we've seen, though, is a lot of the retailers who have brick-and-mortar stores have benefited from that. It sounds a little bit antithetical to the conversation, but they've absolutely benefited because consumers, when they come in their store now, know what they want. They know what they like and what they don't like. And so our retail businesses are able to cater to that after consumers have done some research online. The other thing that's really kind of fun is that when consumers are making purchases on the internet, very often they're making purchases for staples. Now, this is a really general statement, but a lot of times it's the things that they need for their household. But when they're looking for something special, they're looking for a gift, they're not really sure what they want to get their husband or wife for Christmas or for an anniversary, or if they're looking for a birthday gift for a child, they'll very often go to that Main Street business and talk with that owner about what some of the options might be. And a lot of customers return to those businesses because they appreciate the nature of that personal interaction. So that business ethic, that devotion to customer service, certainly is part and parcel to brick-and-mortar retail in South Dakota right now.
So experts say only the top 20% of malls are thriving, and you mentioned malls earlier. So definitely the malls are not enjoying the popularity they did in the 80s, for example. This is an opportunity as the landscape changes for retailers to sort of rethink their location as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we've got a number of members of the South Dakota Retail Association who have formerly had multiple locations. They would say have a downtown location, which is where they started in a lot of cases. And then they opened a second location out in a mall because everybody and their brother was going out to the mall in the 80s and 90s, and so they needed to have a location out in the mall. And then since the downturn in malls, they've returned back to those Main Street stores as their primary location. And if you go around the state of South Dakota, and I've talked about this before, go to Brookings Main Street. It's fun. It's fantastic. Go to Sioux Falls on Main Street. You know, go check out the architecture on Main Street in Yankton. It's an absolute experience unto itself. And so you see things like Main Street Square out in Rapid City, which has led to a really great revitalization of their downtown, along with their sculpture walks, or like a sculpture walk in Sioux Falls, or the Trail of Presidents that is out there in Rapid City. All of these things are part of an experience and have really led to a resurgence of Main Street in a lot of places around South Dakota.
Talk a little bit about how business owners can use social media, can use their experience, the experience of coming in the store, being greeted by a person who, you know, knows who I am, says welcome back,
yep.
And they know who you are. Talk about building connection with individuals, South Dakotans, and visitors.
Well, retail businesses are 100% about communities. I mean, they understand that they operate within a community regardless of the size of the city or town that they're in. Downtown communities are very often a little sub-community unto themselves. And it's even more acute in a place like, we'll say, Miller, which has a really, really good sense of community amongst their downtown. There are a number of other places like that that have this sense of community. And so retail businesses know their customers. They obviously appreciate and value them. And it becomes more almost a familial relationship, a friendship, more than it is a business-to-customer type relationship. And everybody likes that. I mean, I would a lot rather, you know, I've told a lot of people, it's fun to go into a restaurant, for instance, and have someone say, hey, do you want the usual? You know, I think it's the same kind of thing for retail businesses. Hey, you know, are you shopping for your mom again today? Or hey, you know, are you looking for the latest book today? It's a fun thing that is a lot more than just I need stuff. And that personal connection is something that retailers absolutely value and is in part, I think, a factor in the resurgence of Main Street. A lot of consumers are looking for that relationship as well.
For some of the bigger retailers in South Dakota, how should they approach the increase in online sales? You know, maybe they're not seeing some of the benefits that some of the independent small business owners are seeing. What do the big guys have to learn right now, and where are their opportunities?
Well, again, a question we could talk about for a long time. In brief, if you're a larger retailer, if you're the Walmarts, the Targets, the Best Buys, some of the really big retailers, you see that they are changing the way that they go about doing business. For instance, workforce is a challenge. And so when you go to a large retailer, you'll very often go to a self-checkout. A number of consumers prefer self-checkouts because it's quicker or more convenient for them than to go through a checker. Also, for businesses, it's difficult sometimes to get workers. I mean, with workforce in South Dakota being such a challenge, we've got unemployment, you know, below 3%. That's always going to be a challenge. They're also, of course, going to the you can order online and then pick up in the store type of model, or you can order online and drive up and they'll deliver it to your car kind of model. And so that isn't necessarily going to work for a small pharmacy in Lemon, for instance. So the size of your business and the type of your business is really going to dictate how you navigate that changing environment. One thing that's certain, though, is the internet is necessitating a change, regardless of the size or type of your business. Every business right now, with very few exceptions, either has a website or a Facebook presence, or some other type of online social media type of presence. 30 years ago, obviously, that wasn't the case at all. But now it's a near necessity. You know, if you're a hotel, and we've got a number of hotel members, if you're traveling someplace and you're looking to find a hotel, how many times are you thumbing through the yellow pages trying to find a hotel, or how many times are you going online to a travel site like Orbitz or Travelocity or Trivago or whatever to look for your hotel room? All of those kinds of things are being necessitated by the internet, and a lot of that's great. It's great for us, those of us who travel, for those of us who need to buy stuff. It's a great way to find things. It's a great way to have more choice in the products and services that you're looking for.
All right. Is it a good time to start a business in South Dakota? And how do you connect with the South Dakota Retailers Association?
Well, for sure it's a good time to start a business in South Dakota. You know, South Dakota has consistently ranked as one of the states with among the best business climates in the country. It kind of depends on what the year is because they change the criteria from year to year. Okay. But we've been the top state for business in the past and likely will be again, depending on when they revise the criteria yet again. But South Dakota has a fantastic business climate. We also have one of the most productive workforces in the country. And that's something that really goes unnoticed and overlooked a lot of times. Yes, we have 3% or a little bit below unemployment. And so we're not likely to see really, really large industrial scale businesses coming into South Dakota because we just don't have the workforce to support that kind of thing. But what we do have is we have opportunities for a lot of smaller to medium-sized businesses, particularly retail businesses, who are looking for productive employees to support them. And, you know, the Retailers Association knows that workforce is a challenge for a lot of businesses. And so we've got workforce tips and solutions on our website. You asked how to contact us. It's a simple URL. Our website is sdra.org. We also have lots and lots of really good information for businesses who are looking to navigate these changing environments, whether that's regulatory environments on the state and federal level, whether that's tax changes, whether that's simply changes in the way to do business or workforce. Hopefully we've got some tips and tricks on our website at sdra.org to help those businesses out.
Agriculture provides a $32.5 billion economic engine for South Dakota. A July study from the South Dakota Department of Ag reports there are 29,968 farms and 48,913 total producers in the state. With continued pain from closed international markets and depressed commodity prices, some of those producers are trying to find innovative ways to save their farms. With so much of the South Dakota landscape devoted to ag use, changes in the industry and changes in climate will have a major impact on how we use and interact with our landscapes in the future. Megan Jarko is an associate professor at the University of South Dakota, where she's also the Sustainability and Environment Chair. She talked with us this week about how we use our landscapes and the value of native ecosystems. Let's listen. It's no good if you go bankrupt and have to sell out to some corporation, right? So tell me a little bit about how urgent some of those decisions about how we use our landscapes can really feel on a day-to-day basis out in the field.
Well, and I think you are bringing up a really important issue between there's the short-term, really urgent demand of this is how a lot of South Dakotans make their income, and, you know, both directly in agriculture and then these related fields. And so there really are very short-term, you have to decide, can you get your corn in this year? You know, or were your fields flooded and you have to think about something else. And then there are these long-term implications of, do you want this to stay in your family and do something? Or, you know, are you even setting yourself up for systems that you can continue in the long term? Or do you have to look at trying something new? And so I think there really is that very strong tension between there's the short term, and there definitely are big issues in the short term, as you mentioned too, about the, you know, not being able to sell soybeans to China being a huge challenge for farmers. You know, what do they do in the short term? And then they also have these long-term pressures. It just makes it for another really challenging time for farmers.
All right, so putting prairie back on the landscape. Let's answer the big question, why? Why does it matter to have prairie on the landscape, and how much have we already lost?
So we, on the eastern part of the state, are in the tallgrass prairie region, and some estimates are that there is less than a tenth of 1% of the original tallgrass prairie remaining. And almost everyone would agree that there's less than 1% of the tallgrass prairie remaining. And so the tallgrass prairie is our native ecosystem here. In the central part of the state, it would have been like mixed grass, and then the western part would have been shortgrass prairie. But the tallgrass prairie is a region that has enough precipitation for agriculture. The soils from the prairie are exceptionally good, and so it's been, you know, by and large converted into agriculture. And so it's mostly gone. And so getting it back, I think getting our native ecosystem back has a tremendous amount of benefits in terms of biodiversity, you know, carbon sequestration, reducing pollution. It does a lot of services that, you know, historically would have just been provided, but now we have to think about how might we incorporate it into our current landscape, you know, which is used for the economic, you know, activities of a lot of people in the state.
When did this happen? Over decades, centuries? What's the pace of the disappearance of the tallgrass prairie?
A lot of it was homesteading. So with Euro-American settlement of this region, once that it was recognized that this land is really great for farming. And so that was really the big loss. And then South Dakota in the past decade or so, when there was the increased subsidies for corn grain ethanol, then there was another round of loss of grassland from putting more land in corn and soybean production because there was the increased, you know, market for the corn. And so historically, most of it was lost quite a while ago, but we're doing another resurgence in the loss of grassland. Mm-hmm. And even in the whole United States, eastern South Dakota is leading the country in terms of our loss of grassland right now. We're just seeing a lot of loss that isn't seen other places, and it's because of this idea that corn and soybeans, you know, for the past decade had been productive and, of course, profitable. And, of course, this year is challenging.
Right. So when that's lost, you mentioned biodiversity. Like, explain more in depth, please. Like, what is lost? Because those are big words that, you know, are not very specific. What exactly are we losing by losing tallgrass prairie, that much of it at that pace?
Tallgrass prairies, in terms of, let's say, nutrients, don't lose nutrients from the system. The plants would take it up and then they would cycle it back and use it every year. So when we think about, you know, most of the water bodies in the state, you know, having contamination of various sorts, prairies generally don't do that. They don't lose nutrients like that. And if you can incorporate them into agricultural landscapes, they can help, you know, take up some of those nutrients that you end up applying to corn systems or soybean systems but leak out. In terms of, let's say, habitat for animals, you know, that most of the native species in the region would have evolved with the prairies around here. So, for example, like grassland birds, when you look at different groups of animals that are different groups of birds that are declining, grassland birds lead the way, and they needed this habitat. And so the extent to which, you know, we plow it up and put it in other ecosystems, some whole groups of animals, you know, are suffering tremendously because of it. Carbon sequestration, of course, with climate change, one of the things is our emissions are really high. But also as we're taking up parts of the landscape that do biological carbon sequestration, so in the terms of prairie, it holds it in the roots and puts it in the soil, you know, we're losing that and we're putting the carbon up into the air. And so, you know, those are some of the things that we lose when we lose the prairie.
So the challenges of returning, putting prairie back on the landscape, obviously the system of the economic system, the way we feed the world, all these are pretty big challenges to overcome. Where do you begin?
I think there are a lot of different ways we can begin to approach it. And so one, of course, there are government conservation programs, and we should have those. We should continue to use them. But there's only so much of the landscape those can cover. And as we've talked about, the landscape is how a lot of people make their income. And so I think we have to think about how could you make prairies profitable? And that's things where work like the EcoSun Project is trying to give the data to say, you know, here's ways that you could grow this other type of agricultural system in a way that could be profitable. And then there's also the idea of could we do targeted management of the landscape as a way of putting prairie back, but in specific places on the landscape to get disproportionate benefits. So an example of work at Iowa State, you know, they might put 10% of a watershed back into prairie, but see 90% reductions in soil loss from erosion and 90% loss of nutrients, or the nutrients that are kept in the system and not lost as pollution. And so you could, you know, another thing would be to put prairie back in strategically targeted locations and then get a bunch of benefits. And so I think all of those we have to think about as possibilities.
Is it a hard sell in general, or do you hear people really clamoring for it and just saying, yeah, this is something I want to do, but you got to make it so I can do it and survive?
I think a little of both. There's some amount of people don't see it, and an idea of doing something that's very different from what everyone around you is doing is hard, and so that's where we need demonstration areas. But then also, there need to be the support. So with this idea that farming is risky, if you can't get, you know, insurance to do a different crop than corn and soybean, it's really hard to be willing to do that. And so, but farmers are very creative, understand the landscape, understand how to manage it. And so I think the more they could be given freedom to manage in ways that I think a lot of them understand, you know, they would adopt it. It's that the systems that we have set up don't allow that kind of innovation. You know, the farmers aren't incentivized to do the innovation that I think they otherwise would do.
Is it as simple as stopping doing what you were already doing? Or is it more complicated to bring prairie back to say, not only do we have to not do one thing, but we have to do these other 10 things? Tell me how complicated that transition is.
And there is the range. So there could be, you know, from the EcoSun approach where they're stopping drainage tiles, putting the whole landscape back into prairie, you know, is a many-year process and involved quite a bit. Putting strips of prairie into the landscape is not that dissimilar from grassed waterways or other things that farmers are already doing. And so, you know, that one, there'd be some amount of the farmer would have to make sure they didn't spray it when they came through and managed, but not, you know, not as hard to do, whereas some of the things would be, you know, a bigger shift in how the farm was functioning.
For some of our urban listeners, explain drainage tiles.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. So this area, there are wet spots in the landscape. So we have a lot of what are called ephemeral wetlands. And so you might call them ponded spots or low spots, but areas where it's wet. And when you have corn and soybeans, you have to get in the spring and plant the crops. And so you do not want parts on your field where the water stands. And so they put perforated pipe under the ground. And what that functionally does is it lowers the water table and it helps the water move off the landscape more quickly. And so instead of having these low pockets where water kind of sits, you can move it off and then you move the water either into a drainage ditch or into a nearby creek or something. But it's a way of moving the water more quickly off the landscape by putting pipes underground.
And how is it problematic? What kind of problems can it cause for the ecosystem?
Tile drainage. So a big one is that it's moving the water fast, but the other thing that's in the water is nutrients, and particularly nitrogen. So nitrogen is water soluble. It gets in the water, and then it moves right into your water bodies. And so drainage tile really helps exacerbate nitrogen pollution. Another thing that it does is, I mean, what it's supposed to, exactly what it's supposed to do is it moves water off the landscape, but it also means that water is not there doing other things that it could be doing. And so, you know, if you have a drought, you are trying to dry out the landscape on purpose. Another thing that it would do if you have the tile drains in there is naturally around here, for example, we have selenium in the soil, which some people are looking at. It would just normally have stayed in the soil, but now kind of higher levels are moving out, which can be problematic to water bodies. So there's some amount of, it just changes systems in different ways. And so it helps farming in some ways, and then some it causes some challenges.
Talk a little bit about when we talk in this region about solar energy and wind energy and just other ways of generating power. How does that sort of intersect with the work that you do?
So I don't specifically look at, let's say, wind energy or solar energy in terms of specifics of it. But, for example, wind energy is one that is really aligns well with our types of agricultural systems. And so, you know, in states where there's policies to really support it, you see broad adoption. So let's say in, I mean, even Texas, which really leads in a lot of wind power, whereas you can put it on agricultural land. And so you can still farm the land below it, but then, you know, you're getting the wind above it to get renewable energy. And so in South Dakota, we haven't had strong policy to encourage wind energy development, but we certainly could, and we're a windy state and have, you know, it could be, that could align with agriculture extremely well. We would need investments in infrastructure to move the energy, you know, to places that are more populated, but definitely solar or wind energy would fit well in South Dakota. And solar energy, again, that we would have a lot of opportunities. People think about cold states maybe not doing as well. We have very sunny, you know, winters and summers on average. And so we could also add solar energy. And that's another one that isn't incompatible with agriculture. You can make it fit in spaces that wouldn't compete with agriculture.
When we talk about incentives and, you know, we're going to talk later in this program about subsidies for the, you know, during the international trade war and sort of keeping farmers going. And a few of the things you've talked about, you've said, you know, this is something that has to be promoted or sent, you know, there has to be an incentive for it. Then are we in the, what realm are we in there? Is that the realm of politics and sort of people just getting on board with the data science or the data or the research? Tell me how some of the challenges that need to be overcome just to get to the point of opening the door toward different policies.
Yes, I mean, the policy. So a lot of these changes, policy is what holds them in place. And it certainly is often the case. So agriculture and particularly agribusiness has very strong lobbying power. And so it is a challenging area to make change. For example, if you can get crop insurance for corn and soybeans, but you couldn't get crop insurance if you grew prairie to sell for seed, that is a hard thing for someone to say they're going to, you know, plant something that they can't get insurance for if it was a bad year. And so it is hard to get these policy changes because it's a very well-funded, well-organized, you know, agricultural lobby that it would be up against. But policy could make a huge difference. And so I think everyone, sometimes there's the idea that people are thinking that farmers are choosing to not do things that would be in the best interest of the environment. And I think, you know, people who work in the space would recognize that there are pretty strong limitations put on, you know, what is allowable if people want to make farming work for them. And it's not at the level of the individual farmer. It's at the level of these kind of larger policy type or institutional type systems in terms of what they can do, you know, to mitigate risk and expect to make profit.
The The discovery of zebra mussels in a second Missouri River reservoir has prompted Governor Kristi Noem to warn South Dakotans to pull the plugs on their boats after they've had their crafts in the water to prevent contamination. South Dakota Game Fish and Parks Wildlife Division Director Tony Life explains why this invasive species causes problems and how we can prevent those problems from getting worse. All right, the situation is getting a little worse, not better. What's the latest discovery, and how do you make that discovery?
Well, it's just a couple weeks ago that some staff from the Corps of Engineers were doing inspections at Big Bend Dam there next to Fort Thompson and discovered some of these zebra mussels. Not very many of them, but enough to show us that there is a reproducing population in Lake Sharp.
How bad is the problem statewide? How widespread is it?
So currently we have about six or seven waters in South Dakota that have zebra mussels. They're in Lewis and Clark Lake, Lake Yankton, which is almost a part of Lewis and Clark there, McCook Lake, which again has water exchange between the Missouri River and it, and then, of course, the Missouri River below the dam there. So this is up until just a few weeks ago, the only places that we had those in South Dakota. So when with the discovery of finding zebra mussels now in Lake Sharp, the larvae of those zebra mussels are called villagers, and they're like little microscopic size organisms that just float in the water column. So it's obviously floated through the dam and on to the next reservoir down, which is Francis Case. So that's the extent of where we know we have zebra mussels in the state. We've been looking elsewhere, haven't found them, but I can't say with complete certainty that those are the only places, because they could be out there in other places and we just haven't discovered them yet, Lori.
All right. They start out pretty tiny, but then what happens as they expand, as they grow and reproduce?
They're very vigilant in their reproductive. In fact, we've seen the extent of the zebra mussels in Lewis and Clark grow exponentially in the last few years. Once they get to their settling stage, these little villagers latch onto anything hard, and then they grow into these mussels.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about what some of the risks are by having zebra mussels.
Well, zebra mussels are going to cause economic problems in lots of areas because of this buildup that they need to be removed. They're going to be on boats, and they need to be removed from those internal engine systems so they don't overheat. They're going to have to be removed from the dams themselves so that the water can flow through and electricity can be generated still there. You know, when they grab onto other hard surfaces like rocks and docks and logs or whatever else might be out there, I mean, the impact isn't near as what it is on some of those infrastructures that are put in place, but there's certainly an inconvenience and cause problems for water users that enjoy those waters.
Tell us a little bit about the emergency rules from the Game Fish and Parks. What's changed as far as how we're addressing this in a state, in a statewide effort?
Sure. So let's start out with the reasoning behind having these regulations in place, Lori, which I think is first and foremost important. The only way these mussels move from one water body to another is with the assistance of people. These villagers can be transported in water and be kept alive. And in fact, that's how the mussels originally came to North America. They're not native to our country. They came from Europe, and they came in the ballast of barges that came across the Atlantic Ocean and into the Great Lakes. That was in 1986 when they were first detected there, and they've spread from there. So it's important that we don't move water from one water body to another. And we have a generalized rule in place for all water bodies where those plugs have to be pulled. That is the most important thing that we all can be doing, to limit the spread of these mussels from one water body to another. And that doesn't matter which water body we're talking about. If a boat is going down the road, that plug needs to be out of there to ensure that there's no water being transported. So to get on the emergency rule, we have additional rules in place that require decontamination of certain boats that can retain water. There are these wakeboard boats that have a special bladders in them or tubes that you can fill up with water. that cannot be completely drained when they're pulled out of a water body and moved on to the next water body or taken home. So that's where these containment waters, where we know we have those mussels, there are decontamination requirements on those waters, and that is the expansion of the rule that the commission took this last week to include Lake Sharp and Lake Francis Case in those waters where that decontamination needs to occur.
Cheyenne River Sioux tribal officials say they need emergency funding to fix damaged roads, and quickly. Spring flooding washed out roads in some rural areas and forced culverts out from underground in others. Officials link two recent deaths on the reservation to dangerous driving conditions and say other Great Plains tribes have the same problem. SDPB's China Laka toured some of the damage.
It's tough to drive BIA Route 3 on the Cheyenne River Reservation. There are missing chunks of pavement, potholes in some areas, and washed out gravel roads. Tribal officials show off the damage and stop their cars next to neon orange signs. This stretch of road runs along the bank of the Moreau River. A steep cliff drops down into shallow water.
Come back this way, I might cave off on you.
This closed off segment of dirt road is about 6 years old, and now it's at risk of sliding into the river during a flood. That's what happened to the original segment of road built in the 50s. That was replaced with a new section of road higher up on the hillside last fall. Tracy Zephyr is the attorney general for the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. She says over time, the riverbed has moved.
I would say it's probably 100 yards from where the river used to be to where it is now.
The Moreau River feeds into the Missouri River. Zafir says in the 40s and 50s, the federal government built dams along the Missouri River to prevent downstream flooding in states like Arkansas. She says the Owyhee Dam near Pier has forced sediment to collect in the Moreau River.
What it's doing is basically is acting like a big stopper in the bottom of a bathtub. It's so the water can't drain like it naturally, like Mother Nature would allow it to do.
Zafir points out a large island in the center of the river, covered in trees and grass.
If the sediment wasn't on the bottom of this, the river would be able to just scour that, just push it down. But the sediment has raised the bottom of the riverbed up so that this stuff is catching where it wouldn't have caught before.
With higher sediment levels, floods can happen faster. This year, there were several floods on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. Zafir says the levels went over a 20-foot wall onto the roads. Some tribal members living nearby were evacuated.
So what you see here is what happens when you try and alter Mother Nature over the course of 50 years. This is what happens.
Tribes across the country get money each year through the Tribal Transportation Program, a division of the Federal Highway Administration. That's the money that pays to maintain these roads. Harold Frazier is the tribal chairman. He says the nearly $2.3 million they receive isn't enough to solve the problem.
It's going to be in the millions of dollars. I'm maybe around $20 million at a minimum just to fix the damaged parts. And we don't have that type of money on our reservation, so we're kind of stuck in a tough spot right now.
In the past, Frazier says FEMA has helped with several emergency road repairs.
They're a reimbursable program. So when you got $20 million of damage, you got to spend $20 million, then they'll reimburse you 18%. So we don't got $16 or even $4 million. To do this. So it's a big challenge.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs maintains BIA roads. The agency did not respond to questions for this story. Tribal Chairman Frazier says the immediate repairs are not enough to prevent future damage.
We have a road that's been shut down since May 27th because the culvert, it washed out. There's a big hole in the road. Oh, I'm going to say about 40 feet wide and probably 40 feet, 50 feet deep, and it's just sitting there and nobody has worked on it, and it is a BIA road, but they have never, ever responded to it.
Frazier says dangerous roads have caused deaths. He says two people died on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation because of road conditions. He says a washed out culvert on the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota also killed two people. There are similar problems with roads on other reservations, Frazier says are also underfunded.
This year, the tribe applied for funding through a program called Emergency Relief for Federally Owned Roads.
It's a program out of federal highways, and back in May, they instructed our transportation director, don't do any work until it is authorized. And then so we sat back, and then around 4th of July, we started pressuring, calling, and still not getting any results.
Frazier says they're still waiting for authorization to fix the damaged roads on the reservation. A spokesperson for the Federal Highway Administration responded by email saying the department is working with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. He says the tribe can move ahead with repairs and that the agency is helping them apply for funding. The spokesperson said emergency repairs are already finished in several locations. Representatives from U.S. Senators John Thune and Mike Rounds' office say they are aware of the road conditions in Eagle Butte. Both support increased and emergency funding for tribal infrastructure. Cater Ward is a district council representative for the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. He answers questions as we drive down BIA Route 3. His main concern is people's safety.
Response time for the ambulance and for fire trucks, for children going to and from school, you just have to add on another extra half an hour or hour to travel down these bad roads. You have to go that much slower and dodge out many more holes, and hopefully there's not a culvert washed out ahead of you that you might not see.
Ward says Route 3 is the way many residents get to businesses in town centers for work and school. He says some roads are frequently closed down because of flooding, and school buses have had to find alternate routes.
They've band-aided this so much that the band-aid is not sticking no more, and we need some urgency help. Soon as possible.
The tribal council wants to make repairs before school starts later this month to prevent future accidents. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Chyna Lockett on the Cheyenne River Reservation.
Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all our conversations at listen.sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at sdpbinthemoment. And Twitter at MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.